Refugees and border walls, woke celebs and socialist chic, social engineering and COVID lockdowns. It's easy to get wound up over what's happening in our country and in the world. That's why it's time for Act and Unwind, a weekly roundtable discussion tackling current events from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. Every Monday, join host Eric Cohen and Acton Institute experts, including Dr. Samuel Gregg, Reverend Robert Sirico, Dr. Stephen Barrows, and more in this weekly audio public square where news, politics, religion, and culture meet for an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. Act and Unwind will explain the news of the week through the Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics as it works to promote and to shape a society that is secure, free, and virtuous, one characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Act and Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or search Act and Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are available. That's acton.org/NR. To subscribe, please check it out. Should we fear Omicron? Why did Waukesha disappear? And will Chris Cuomo go? We'll discuss all this more and do this one more time. 3, 2, 1. Should we fear Omicron? Why did Waukesha disappear? And will Chris Cuomo go? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lauren. I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zanda Sanctus, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Made In and Babbel. More about them in due course. If you listen to this podcast on nationalreview.com, we're delighted to have you, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed at any of the streaming services out there, from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, this all feels a little random, but for some reason, the Omicron variant all of a sudden is all the news. It was an obsessive topic on the Sunday shows this past weekend. I was reading up on this variant and had forgotten about all the other variants that were briefly causes of concern, and they completely disappeared and were forgotten, except for Delta. And a problem with a lot of those variants is that they couldn't outcompete Delta, even though they might have had other worrisome features. And it's unclear whether Omicron will actually outcompete Delta and become a big thing or not.
Yeah, I tried to walk a tightrope in the Morning Jolt newsletter on Monday, and I guess I did it okay. I think most reporting, which really kind of intensified right around Thanksgiving, did not walk that tightrope. You know, should we keep an eye on Omicron? Sure. You know, if you are concerned about catching COVID-19, yeah, you probably want to stay on top of that, but it's just right now far too early to tell whether it is really represents any type of a game changer for the state of the pandemic. And most notably, what the early evidence out of South Africa does indicate that this thing is really, really contagious. There's something called the replication number, or the, you know, R0 factor. The one first, you know, COVID, when it first appeared in Wuhan, was like a 2-something. And the Delta variant put it up to about a 5. Now, that's pretty, basically means the average person who catches it is going to spread it to 5 people. That's bad. High numbers are bad. But it can go even higher. Chickenpox has an even higher one. And it's possible that the Omicron variant, which, oh, by the way, sounds like some, like, you know, Robert Ludlum novel title, or a villain from a Transformers movie or something like that. Omicron could be really bad. But at this point, it's too early to tell. And in fact, the South African doctor who'd been treating the patients said that so far the symptoms have been mild. If you could get a really contagious version of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, if you get a really contagious version of the virus that doesn't give really bad effects, that actually might be something of a blessing in disguise. Everybody gets it. They develop the antibodies. Hopefully they don't succumb to it or have really serious side effects, or end up in the hospital on respirators, all that kind of stuff. And then they'd have antibodies so that if they did run into the virus again, they'd be protected against it. I don't know that that's the case. Again, it's too early to tell, but man, some of the coverage over Thanksgiving weekend, you would have thought they'd discovered the Andromeda strain. Captain Trips from The Stand of Stephen King or something like that. There was, and of course, all of the reactions just kicked into overdrive. New York State Governor Kathy Hochul's already said it's time to stop. Non-essential medical activities should be postponed. Look, we don't have a case of we don't have a confirmed case of Omicron here in the United States yet. We're probably going to get one real soon. In fact, it might very well be here, but everybody has reacted to it. And I think it demonstrates that at this point in the pandemic, more than 2 years, because at least according to some sources, this was, you know, floating around in China by, you know, November of 2019, entering year three, the rules and the laws that are and the regulations and the restrictions that are set for this pandemic are set by public health officials and experts who we've already demonstrated are the most risk-averse people in the whole wide world. They don't spend their weekends skydiving or doing anything like that. A media that loves a story and the media that wants a dramatic story, and nobody wants to write a headline saying, this variant might be a big deal, it might not, too early to tell, stay tuned. And government officials who are just utterly addicted to this, you know, emergency powers and this dramatic expansion of their authority and their, you know, Gretchen Whitmer being able to tell you you can't buy seeds in Walmart or whatever the heck, you know, store it was. There's nobody around who's saying, actually, this might not be that bad. And imposing these kinds of restrictions has all kinds of terrible economic consequences, social consequences, psychological and emotional consequences. We are now all attuned onto this hair trigger to have the maximum response to any potential bad news on the horizon. And very frustrating, very depressing. I think we're jumping the gun. Yes, it involves a certain amount of caution, but no, you shouldn't. It's not a call for a need for quarantines. And I suppose the good news, and you can't see me making air quotes as I say that, is that President Biden said that, you know, lockdowns are off the table for now, which I guess means they aren't really off the table now, are they?
Yeah, so Zan, it's just clear for some people, panic is a way of life. They enjoy panic. It gives them a frisson of excitement. But it's the fact that you'd be declaring a state of emergency in a United States state, let alone suspending surgeries, you know, that really important for people based on this fear over this variant that we know nothing about, really. It's not clear that it's more transmissible, might be, but it, maybe the indications of that just have to do with the sample that's been taken in South Africa. It's not clear whether it's more virulent or not. We really know nothing about it. We have no idea what the effects are going to be. And it would seem as though what's most called for is just the status quo. Unless you have some compelling reason not to, get vaccinated, get boosted, take whatever individual precautions you consider personally prudent and appropriate, and then get on with it.
Yeah, and what you just said, Rich, is basically has been my attitude towards COVID, the initial COVID, toward COVID variant, the Delta variant and subsequent variants, especially since the vaccines have come out and have been at least very effective at the most important thing, which is preventing people from having very serious effects if they do contract COVID. You know, it doesn't stop people from contracting COVID, it seems. It doesn't stop people from spreading it, but it does stop you some huge amount of the time from, you know, ending up in the hospital, ending up on a ventilator, and dying, which are the most important things. And I know I've said this on this podcast before, but I'm just a little bit confused about whether our end game is no one ever getting COVID again, or, you know, COVID no longer existing before we can exit this panic pandemic state, or if our goal is to make it such that if you get COVID, you're kind of down for the count for a few days, maybe like most people with the flu or a common cold at some point, like that should be our goal. And I think with the vaccine, that goal has pretty much arrived. And, you know, there are some variations where we don't know exactly how the vaccine will handle a new variant, perhaps. But the idea that we should be in this, you know, constant state of panic, always thinking that the new variant is going to put us back in March 2020 is just not dealing in reality. And Jim alluded to this, but I think there are the groups of people who we hear from most often on this topic, the public health officials, the media and politicians, Democratic politicians in particular, have some sort of vested interest in keeping us in a March 2020 COVID state, as if that's how we always have to be until COVID no longer exists somehow magically. And we're just not going to get there. And I, for one, am very sick of hearing from these groups of people. I don't think that they are telling us the truth. If I want to know what to think about a new variant of COVID, I read Jim Garrity. I don't listen to the CDC. I don't listen to basically any mainstream media source. I don't know who I can trust because they all have some kind of interest in telling us that it's way more serious than it probably is. And I could be wrong about that, but judging from what's happened over the last year and a half, I don't have much reason to trust any of those groups of people. And I think more and more people are starting to feel that way about them.
So, Charlie, I'm kind of done making predictions about this virus. I mean, you've written very compellingly about, you know, it's not a red state thing. It's not a blue state thing. We see that going on now. Florida, you know, which Paul Krugman and others have been obsessed by, now has the lowest rate of cases of anywhere in the United States, clearly because a huge element of this is driven by weather, which is outside of control of any public policy maker. And these variants, it's just hard to know, and you have to see what actually happens. I would have thought Delta wasn't going to be as serious as it was. It ended up being a really serious event, but that doesn't mean the next variant is going to be as serious.
I've become something of a broken record on this. I think that it is over. That doesn't mean that coronavirus has disappeared, but the pandemic is over and they're separate. The virus is now endemic, and we will see various iterations of it. But unless one of them is indeed the Andromeda strain, then our policy should be to contain it without destroying people's lives and livelihoods. And we've learned a great deal of things over the last 2 years. The first one is that the virus doesn't care who's president. It doesn't care who is governor. It doesn't care which party has a majority in the state legislature. The second is that the virus doesn't care about your public policy. It doesn't care if you're conservative or progressive. It doesn't care if you ask people to wear masks. It doesn't care if you cancel operations. And the third thing is that the vaccine works. The vaccine is not perfect. It doesn't prevent transmission. And it doesn't prevent breakthrough cases, but it mostly saves people's lives. It has made an enormous difference. And what it has done above everything else is allow us to go back to normal. The purpose of beating coronavirus is not to beat coronavirus. The purpose of beating coronavirus is so that we can be free, so that we can enjoy our civilization. And I think far too many people have forgotten this. They have come to see beating it as an end in and of itself. It has become a white whale. But that's not how we approach or should approach threats. It's not how we approach foreign policy threats. It's not how we approach domestic threats. And it shouldn't be how we approach viruses or health threats either. So where are we now? We are in a stable place. We have a virus that is available, a vaccine rather, that is available to everyone. We have a virus that is mutating, but that has not yet done so in a way that has breached the vaccine. And we have a free country in which some people, most people, have chosen to avail themselves of the vaccine, and in which others have not. We are a long, long way from early 2020. And it seems to me that it is ridiculous. It is ignorant, in fact. It is monomaniacal to hear President Biden refuse to rule out lockdowns, not that he has the authority to impose them. It is ridiculous that when asked what we should do, Joe Biden mutters the same few words: boosters, masks. It is ridiculous that Anthony Fauci is still being asked by journalists, forget for a moment his answers, whether we will be able to have Thanksgiving, able to have Christmas. We're past all of that. And I think it's high time that normal people who wish to be free, who are not reckless, but who are able to weigh competing interests and information, take back the country from the hysterics and the agoraphobes who are, for whatever reason, continuing to cling on to this as if it represents the future rather than the past.
So, Jim, there have now been more COVID deaths under Biden than there were under Trump. And this clearly is another factor. We haven't talked about it that much, but clearly another factor that's playing into Biden's abysmal poll ratings was this. This was one of the main things he campaigned on, is that he was going to defeat, shut down the virus, but not shut down the country or the economy. And the virus hasn't been shut down, you know, mostly, largely, almost entirely for reasons out of his control. But still, he attributed almost every COVID death to Trump, where there wasn't much Trump could have done differently. The biggest Trump mistake that Trump made was a political one of repeatedly saying that the end of the virus was just a couple weeks away, when that obviously was untrue, and made himself a hostage to fortune repeatedly.
You know, when you spend a lot of time criticizing Donald Trump, a lot of people will just reflexively accuse you of voting for Joe Biden. I did not vote for Joe Biden. But once it was clear Joe Biden had won the election, I was like, okay, maybe we have a chance of getting some stability. Maybe we have a chance of getting some, you know, we're going to trade one set of problems for another, but maybe I'll like these problems better than the old problems. Well, right now, the Biden problems look pretty darn bad. And think of this as a bonus editor's pick. I think my podcast colleague, Charlie Cook, had a fantastic piece, Biden's Bumbling COVID Policy. Hey, look, there are few things that were more arrogant and more insufferable and more blatantly nonsensical than the tweet that turned into kind of one of Biden's rallying cry. I'm not going to shut down the country. I'm not going to shut down the economy. I'm going to shut down the virus. Like there's a button to press just as labeled shut down the virus in the Oval Office, and that Donald Trump had just been too stubborn to not press it. This was never going to end on January 21st, 2021. It was kind of ridiculous for Biden to act like just a few policy changes, presto changeo, we're going to make this go, make the virus go away. The virus is not shut down. There was a lot of this on the unvaccinated. Yeah, although let's keep in mind that a chunk of those unvaccinated people have got the virus and they believe that they have natural immunity. And most of the studies say, yeah, once you got the virus, you got a pretty decent amount of natural immunity, and you know, you don't necessarily need the vaccine. Vaccine's not going to hurt getting it. It's only going to enhance it. But I'm very pro-vaccination, very anti-vaccine mandate. But Biden's basically, that's the only tool he has. He really doesn't. He was, you know, you saw how hesitant and how the reluctance to restore regular travel passage and all that kind of stuff. It's actually much harder to get a handle under a very contagious virus than Biden wanted to make it sound like on the campaign trail. Charlie's piece did a fantastic job labeling this out. And I think that this is at the inherent of a lot of problems that Joe Biden has. He just kind of figured that by him being there in the Oval Office, by just being himself and being good old Joe, that these problems would solve themselves. Surprise, surprise, they don't. It's not a matter of just being good Democrats suddenly makes problems go away. And as we've seen in cases like the supply chain issues and inflation and the border, actually some of your policies are going to make things much, much worse. The Biden administration is kind of an arrogant about this. I think if you want to look back to where they first hit their first real problem, was the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that ended up being over a handful of cases and I think freaked people out. I think it made people think the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was unsafe. And, you know, all of these steps kind of ended up fueling a certain amount of vaccine hesitancy. But oh, by the way, I think it's also worth keeping in mind that, yes, vaccines keep, you know, are very likely to keep you out of the hospital. You're likely to not die. Doesn't mean you won't get infected. And oh, by the way, for a long time, almost all of our pandemic and quarantine and regulation policies were designed on, you know, measuring case counts. But once people are vaccinated, getting the virus themselves is not necessarily a crisis. It's not necessarily a really big problem. So people are like, oh, cases are up, things are bad. Well, not necessarily. If we're all vaccinated, we're okay. The other thing to keep in mind, as we saw in the case of Colin Powell, if you are elderly or if you're immunocompromised or if you have a whole bunch of comorbidities, there's a chance that getting vaccinated might not save you. You know, COVID-19 can still kill you. Now, again, you're probably elderly. But when you're elderly, you're immunocompromised, or you have a whole bunch of comorbidities, a lot of things are more likely to kill you, not just COVID-19. So I think you look at all that. Yes, you know, Biden, you know, inherited a big problem. You know, every president inherits big problems from their predecessor, almost every president. And Biden assured us he could shut it down, that this was going to be easy. The honest answer is that Biden had no idea what he was doing, and he just kind of assumed things would get better once he was in office. And it turns out that having vaccinations by itself was not going to make the go away. And oh, by the way, if you're worried about the American, so some unvaccinated American whose body becomes this petri dish to allow the virus to mutate and become more dangerous, I think it's pretty unlikely. I mean, could it happen? Sure. It could happen to anybody. But like 44% of the world hasn't been vaccinated at all. So the idea that, you know, if it's going to vaccinate, if it's going to mutate into something really new and different and dangerous, it's probably going to happen in somebody who, you know, has never had an opportunity to get the vaccine, because this virus is still floating around all around the world. And it's probably going to be here for quite a while.
So, Zan, next question to you. You expect more COVID shutdowns to come. Yes or no?
I don't expect it, although I do think there are parts of the country where more restrictions unnecessary will continue to be in place and possibly come back stronger. But I don't think that any lockdowns like what we've seen in the past will come back again.
Charlie?
Well, not where I live, no. It's possible it will happen elsewhere.
Jim Garrity?
Locally. Yes, absolutely, definitely locally. Hopefully our listeners don't live in those places. And if they do, maybe you want to move.
Yeah, there will definitely be more lockdowns. It is just the go-to answer for certain localities where blue politicians think a certain way about how to fight this virus. With that, let's pause and hear from our first sponsor this episode, Made In. If quality and craftsmanship is important to you, you should check out Made In. Made In is a cookware and kitchenware brand that works with renowned chefs and artisans to produce some of the world's best pots, pans, knives, and wine glasses. I can personally vouch for the latter. We have a bunch of Made In wine glasses here. They're elegant. They look great on the table, and they very quickly became our favorite wine glasses. Made In produces professional quality cookware and knives for those who love to cook. They source the finest materials and partner with renowned craftsmen to make premium kitchen tools available directly to you without the markup. Made In products are made to last, and they offer a lifetime guarantee. Their cookware distributes heat evenly and can easily go from the stovetop to the oven, and their knives are fully forged, perfectly balanced, and stay sharp. They have 28,000 five-star reviews, and their products are used by some of the world's best chefs at Michelin-starred restaurants around the world. Made In, better cookware for better meals. Right now, Made In is offering our listeners 15% off your first order with the promo code editors. This is the best discount available anywhere online for Made In products. Go to madeincookware.com/editors and use the promo code editors for 15% off your first order. That's madeincookware.com/editors. Use the promo code editors. I guarantee you, you won't regret it. So, Zan, we had this horrific Christmas parade attack in Waukesha, this utter reprobate and cretin repeat offender deliberately mowed people down in his car. It seemed like it was going to be a media obsession for maybe 12, 18 hours, as long as they thought perhaps it would fit a convenient political narrative. Perhaps this was a right-wing vigilante type or someone energized by the Rittenhouse trial or whatever. Turned out none of that was true, didn't fit the narrative at all, and this mass murder has just dropped off the media radar screen.
Yeah, this drives me crazy. And honestly, I mean, I think as long as I've been paying attention to politics, so maybe the last 10 years or so, I guess, the media has been like this. And so I think I've gotten to a point where, you know, not covering things that fit their narrative, I mean, and I've gotten to the point where I just kind of don't notice it, or I take for granted that this is the way that they are. And so it almost doesn't outrage me anymore, because I just factor it in and assume this is the way that things are going to be. But every so often, it just really drives me crazy when I stop and think about it and think about how dishonest it is to, you know, spend weeks and weeks, months, actually, I guess, focusing on Kyle Rittenhouse focus in on the trial, you know, essentially cover it in a way that lies about it, or spins this false narrative about him being some kind of racist and having this laser focus on that story. And then a horrible crime, a horrific crime happens that doesn't fit whatever racial narrative they want to push. And it might as well not have happened. And you know what happened with Rittenhouse was unfortunate, of course. But this was an actual intentional murder of children, elderly people at a Christmas parade. And they don't want to pay attention to it. They don't want to cover it. They don't want to talk about it on the Sunday shows because the racial message or the criminal is not fitting the racial message that they would like to send about what's going on in America. That is absolutely outrageous. And it, I suppose there's nothing that really can be done about it. They can't be forced to cover these things honestly. They can't be forced to do justice to the news. But I just sometimes really wish that there were places I could go other than, you know, your National Review or other sites here and there like that to get actual information from people. And it drives me absolutely crazy that they get away with this.
Yeah, Charlie, I think there's one reference in passing on a Sunday show this past weekend about Waukesha. Obviously, that would have been completely different if it fit the narrative that the media preferred. And, you know, there are indications that this guy, you know, we don't know his motives besides being a hateful maniac, but you know, his social media posts, if they were right-wing social media posts that expressed hatred towards Black people, they would have been a total obsession. Instead, since they're the opposite and they have, you know, anti-white sentiments, etc., that doesn't play at all for the press.
People don't like it when you play what if, but I think what if is instructive. And it is instructive to ask, what if he'd had a gun? If he'd had a gun, it's all that would have been talked about for a week more. And it's not just that it would have been talked about ad nauseam, but it's how it would have been talked about. There is a political angle to this. Irrespective of any views that this individual may or may not have held, and irrespective of whether there's a nexus between it and the Rittenhouse trial, neither of which are clear. The political angle is bail reform. This is a real thing. And whatever one thinks about it, it intersects perfectly with this case. And it's got no attention whatsoever. If it had been a gun, though, we would have had the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN calling for federal laws. It would have been extrapolated out. It would have shown the need for this or that. It would have said this or that about America. But it doesn't. And in fact, not only is this irrelevant, but all of the agency has been taken away from the perpetrator. The Washington Post had a bizarre story. It wasn't just their tweet, in which the SUV was treated as if it were a self-driving car. The SUV went down this street. The car then turned left. The SUV then plowed into a child. No, it didn't. The SUV was driven deliberately by a person with a name and a history. And that person was out because of decisions that we have made as to how our criminal justice system will work. Now, I am, when it comes to tragedies, something of a wait-and-see guy. And I don't like overreactions. I don't like overreactions whether we're talking about somebody plowing down innocent people with a car, somebody shooting up a Walmart, a terrorist planting a bomb, domestic violence. I don't like overreactions. I actually think that these incidents tell us very little. I think trying to reorganize or draw profound conclusions about your society based on the actions of madmen or evil men is usually folly and usually leads to a diminishment in liberty. But my goodness, it would be nice to have some sort of consistent principle. And it's not even the case that this was different because it was a car. It was different because, as Alexander says, it just doesn't fit any narrative that the press is invested in. We had an incident in which an American, for political reasons, tried to murder a quarter of the Senate. And had it not been for a very talented and quick and brave police officer, he might well have succeeded. And it's gone. That disappeared pretty quickly as well. And it just gets so tiresome. It gets so predictable. There are people on Twitter who will point out within minutes whether the story is going to disappear or not, based upon the political views or the immutable characteristics or the contextual effect of the perpetrator and the circumstances in which the event happened. And I think the fact that it has become so easy for those people to determine the likely response from the supposedly non-biased press is a damning indictment of where we are with journalism.
So, Jim, there is, as Charlie mentioned, a direct public policy consequence here, though, a takeaway, which is bail reform has, at the very least, gone too far. I would say it's been an utter debacle from beginning to end. But that clearly is one of the lessons here, if anyone would take any interest in it. But no one in the mainstream media has such interest.
You know, not every offender who was given a weekend furlough under Michael Dukakis went out and committed horrible, violent crimes. But Billy Horton did, which made it a really terrible idea. You're going to see a similar backlash against bail reform. But I think, look, we don't know the perpetrator's motive yet. We can certainly take some guesses. We can certainly take some, have our suspicions. And I think one of the things, first of all, it is normal in these kinds of stories that you get some early reports that aren't quite right. There were some early ones that said he was fleeing from an altercation. No, apparently he was involved in a domestic disturbance. He was fleeing from someone who's trying to stab him. Does not appear to be the case. But even then, even if you look at the long rap sheet of this perpetrator, even if you say, who knows why he did it? He's an angry, violent man. Running down lots of people, including lots of children, in a Christmas parade is a really extreme act, even for a violent, angry man. This was clearly not just a momentary lapse in judgment, or clearly this was, the expression malice aforethought. There's no way he accidentally ended up driving into the Christmas parade and plowing through all of those people. Cops are saying that he appeared, despite some people's amateur assessments of the video, that no, it looks like he was trying to hit as many people as possible. So by that said, this is a terrorist attack. We don't know, it was not necessarily done in the name of a political cause or an ideological cause, or at least we don't know what that is yet, but this intent was to terrorize people. It was meant to terrorize all the people at that parade. Now, I went back and I checked. I think it was 2002. Philadelphia Daily News was doing a report on violent offenders in the city of Philadelphia. And they went through and they took a whole bunch of pictures of the people who are on the city's most wanted list. And they happened to select, I think, like 15 or 16 photos, and all of them were African-American. And African-Americans in Philadelphia were quite angered and horrified by this. And I think it's understandable that if you say, look, if all of the pictures of violent offenders in this city are African-American, you're communicating to the public, you'd make it think that only Black men commit murders. We know that's not the case. We know that Black men are not the only people who commit crimes. And so the newspaper apologized, everybody pledged to do better and stuff like that. And if you do believe that, okay, media coverage that focuses on one type of problem, one type of crime, can create an inaccurate assessment that make a belief that people, that one group of people is committing these crimes, and that these are the only ones you need to worry about, or that this group of people is inherently bad or inherently dangerous or inherently menacing to their fellow citizens. Okay, well, that's a reasonable argument. I wouldn't want people going around with inaccurate beliefs and believing that this group of people, this African-Americans or anybody else, you should be afraid of them. They are dangerous. Lock them up. They're all criminals. But if you cover, say, the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, And the entire theme of the coverage is that this is rampant and violent, uncontrollable white supremacy. If your coverage is suggesting that armed young men are running through the streets, and if all of your coverage suggests that the criminal justice system never holds white men or white people accountable for all the terrible things that they do to minorities, well, then could somebody get in their head that, oh my goodness, my community is under attack by a majority that is malevolent and violent and cruel, and that the best way for me to fight back is to drive my SUV through the Christmas parade? Look, we don't know that's what made him do it. But it's certain the fact that it happened in Wisconsin, the fact that this guy's social media posts and all that, it doesn't seem crazy. It doesn't seem utterly unreasonable. Now, at some point, he's going to be arraigned. At some point, there's going to be a trial. And the prosecutor is going to discuss the motive for this. But the fact that this story went from justifiably huge story, oh, my God, did you hear what happened in that town in Wisconsin? Oh, my God, did you see the video? God, can you imagine that happening to your child? And then all of a sudden, like that, it disappears. The story just fades away. The moment you saw the guy, the moment you heard about the social, as Charlie and you know, observed, like people said on Twitter, you're never going to hear about this. It doesn't fit the narrative. And it did. And it did disappear. There are still kids in the hospital. The fact that you stop hearing about something doesn't mean the story went away. It just meant that large people, the TV show producers, the cable news bookers, the people who decide what goes on the front page, the people who decide what goes on the magazine covers, besides our magazine, and you know, those folks decided that's just not that interesting a story anymore. It became, as they tried to say about Gosnell, that you know butcher who claimed to be an abortionist, local crime story. Nothing more to see here. There are no lessons to be learned. We know what you know, we know the difference between check the box journalism and the drumbeat journalism, where you're like, this is a story. There are lessons. There are broader lessons we should all take from this. And if it had been a, you know, MAGA hat wear, if it had been the kind of guys that Jussie Smollett said attacked him, who perpetuated this attack on the parade, you'd be hearing a lot about this. We're still hearing about January 6th. We're still hearing about Charlottesville. But this one, there are no broader lessons to be learned. It's just a thing that happened. It's really tragic. Time to move on. Or at least that's the mentality in a lot of reporters these days.
So, Charlie, while we're talking about narrative and the criminal justice system, we'd be remiss if we didn't note the verdict in the Ahmaud Arbery case. And this is another thing that basically disappeared without a trace. We heard after the Rittenhouse verdict that white people, they always get off when they claim self-defense. Self-defense is a racialized concept. Criminal justice system goes back to 1619, and it is designed to serve the interests of white supremacy. And then here you have this case in Georgia, where these three guys suspected Arbery was up to no good at this partially constructed home. They followed and attempted to detain him. And then when Arbery was alarmed and charged one of these guys, the guy shot him. And the key issue, just like in the Rittenhouse case, was who was the aggressor. And the jury determined actually the three guys who were wrong about him and had no reason to chase after him and try to detain him, they were the aggressors. And it was not an act of self-defense to shoot him. Almost nothing about this verdict. I was very interested in what Nicole Hannah-Jones had to say about it, because she went on various Twitter rants about the Rittenhouse case and how this was the racialized American criminal justice system at work. I think she had one tweet, might even have been a retweet, about the Arbery verdict when it came down, and the rest of her tweets were about how she was weeping and just so moved that her new book was at the number one slot on the bestseller list of her own newspaper. And again, this was a verdict that showed our criminal justice system is fair, that juries consider the evidence and the law at hand, and they very often, more often than not, act reasonably. And that was something that didn't compute for the other side, or at least they didn't want to take it on.
I asked last week what the people who were calling for the criminal justice system to be rebuilt from the ground up wanted to change. And I noted that their complaints are vague. They want to get rid of juries, presumption of innocence, objective law, And it was telling that when the verdict came down in the Ahmaud Arbery case, no one said a word. And I wondered, do they still want to burn down the system? Because from my perspective, those two cases were a triumph of the American system of justice. The juries were responsible, sober. The law was upheld. Nobody cared outside of the press about the racial element outside of where prejudice was present. Aubrey's father outside of the courtroom said all lives matter, not just black lives. Kyle Rittenhouse said in an interview, why did people want to see me fried? Can you imagine if somebody who had less institutional support had been in my position? Both of them are right. The villains here are the people who want to burn it down. Who want to burn it down because they don't believe in justice. They don't distinguish between facts. They just see color. And they twist everything around that one dull, immutable characteristic. So I would repeat what I said last week. The system works. It doesn't need destroying. It doesn't need reassembling. And we have an answer now to the always silly rhetorical question asked throughout the Rittenhouse trial. Well, what if? What if this case involved a non-white person and it was a white person who stood to lose? We know the answer. That jury in Georgia didn't just convict, it convicted in the harshest possible terms on pretty much every single charge. I think we should close our ears to the naysayers here.
Next question to you, Zan. Rate the media failure on Waukesha 0 to 10. 0, no big deal. 10, total outrage.
I guess I'd put it at an 8, but that's kind of grading on a curve because I'm comparing it to all their other outrageous coverage of various things, and so I'm not sure it rises fully to a 10 on their scale.
Jim Garrity.
I'll agree with Alexandra's assessment, 8.
Charlie Cook.
Yeah, I think it's an 8.
I'm going to go much lower. I'm going to go a 5 because I am grading on a curve, and they didn't make anything up. You know, it wasn't like the Russian obsession. They just ignored something, which by the media standards today isn't so bad. Still bad, but not nearly as bad as some of the other stuff we've been subjected to over the last 3 or 4 years. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode, Babbel. Learning a new language can feel intimidating. You can, for understandable reasons, be worried about the level of difficulty, the time commitment, and having to hear how your accent sounds out loud. But thanks to Babbel, the number one selling language learning app, the whole process will be addictively fun, fast, and easy. Whether you want to learn a new language for an upcoming trip or as an engaging new hobby, Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons for real-world use. Babbel's 15-minute lessons make it the perfect way to learn a new language on the go. Other language learning apps use AI for the lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 100 language experts. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of three. Just go to babbel.com and use the promo code editors. That's BABBEL.com. Code editors, Babbel, language for life. Please check it out. So, Zan, we have more on the Cuomo brother front. Andrew, of course, was forced to resign under a tsunami of accusations about inappropriate conversation and contact with various women who were near him or working with him. We knew Chris Cuomo had a role in the damage control operation. He apologized for it. He said he was never going to talk about the case again. He said, you know, family for him comes first over and above business. But now we have a new report out that goes into detail, and his involvement was incredibly extensive. He actually worked his sources to try to see what new revelations might be coming out when his brother was in the thick of this. There is a message that suggests he was trying to find out more information about one of the accusers. What do you make of it?
Well, I can't say I'm especially surprised by the news. This is hardly the first scummy thing Chris Cuomo has done in the last year alone. And part of me thinks, well, it's understandable that a brother would want to help his brother. And, you know, of course, the way in which he did it was problematic. But then you stop and think, well, help him with what, right? If he was helping him get out of some sort of trouble that he was in unjustly or some kind of attack on him that wasn't fair, that would be a noble, I guess, motivation on the part of a family member. I understand wanting to be loyal to family. But if you're helping him cover up or twist arms or get out of trouble for doing something horrible or a series of horrible or unfortunate things to other people, that's actually not a noble or loyal motivation. I can understand being sad for your brother or your family member, you know, wanting to support them in some way, but I can't understand wanting to cover up their tracks or, help them get out of trouble when they ought to be in trouble when they've done something wrong. And then on top of that, not only did he try to help his brother get out of trouble for a series of things he pretty clearly did very wrong, but he did it by exploiting his role at CNN. And if you really do decide that as a brother, you want to help your brother cover his tracks or get out of trouble for something he did wrong, questionable. But if you want to do that, then you resign and you maybe use your former connections from working at CNN and see if people still want to help you, if that's something you want to do. But you don't do it while you are working at CNN. This is so obviously unethical. And I'm not sure. I think maybe even CNN will have to draw a line here. I don't know what to predict about that. But I think it's very, very obviously problematic and unethical that he would do this.
Yeah, Jim, I'm a little sympathetic to the, you got to help your brother no matter what impulse. And I just, it always makes me a little queasy joining a firing squad, calling for someone to be fired. But Zan makes a very important distinction. This wasn't like, Governor Cuomo's infrastructure bill was in trouble and needed to find the best way to sell it. And Chris was looking over the speech and suggesting verbiage. He was helping him try to navigate through a scandal where he is guilty. And at some level, Chris must have known he was guilty. He knows his brother, but he wanted to help him be impervious. And on a topic that's been really sensitive to people who think like Chris Cuomo, to the world that Chris Cuomo swims in, sexual harassment and sexual assault. But he, as Ann says, crossed a number of ethical lines here. And if he were anyone except, the highest rated primetime show on CNN, which is not saying a lot, but that's what he is, he would clearly be dumped immediately by CNN.
Rich, I cannot believe you would say that, because I was informed by CNN's own Chris Cillizza back on October 16th, 2016, quote, "Let me say for the billionth time, reporters don't root for a side, period." Chris Cillizza deserves every bit of grief he gets for that. But I think this, not only rooting for a side, Chris Cuomo was working for a side, right? He was basically trying to do this. Oh, by the way, we are recording this on November 30th. It was a little more than 2 months ago. September 24th, the New York Times, kind of a pretty well-read newspaper, particularly in the media circles. Shelley Ross, veteran television journalist, former executive producer at ABC and CBS. The headline, Chris Cuomo sexually harassed me. I hope he'll use his power to make change. And well, you might say, he said, she said. Look, she printed, she had a image of an email that Chris Cuomo sent to Shelley Ross saying, Kristen Slater got arrested for a kind of similar act, though born of an alleged negative intent unlike my own. And as a husband, I can empathize with not liking to see my wife patted as such. Basically, he grabbed her tush. So pass along my apology to your very good and noble husband, and I apologize to you as well for even putting you in such a position. Next time, I will remember the lesson, no matter how happy I am to see you. First of all, Chris Cuomo is lucky he has all of his teeth. You grab a woman's butt in front of her husband, you better be ready for whatever is going to come your way. And, not that I'd like to think this is naturally discouraged, but yeah, don't try that with Mrs. Garrity. But secondly, so this happened. Did Chris Cuomo have any real serious career consequences because of this? No, right? It was a one-day story. Another one of those, Rush Limbaugh used to describe the drive-by media. It was a bad news cycle for Chris Cuomo, and then he went back to hosting his show. Nothing happened. We found out that he grabbed a woman's ass in front of her husband. We heard about it. She's got the apology note. There's really no disputing it. He remembers it differently. And nothing happened. So, why was Chris Cuomo so eager to defend his brother of sexual harassment allegations? Because he does the same thing. They're cut from the same cloth. They're not different guys. So here we are. And so the last thing I'm just to observe here, in addition to, saying how maybe Chris Cuomo, maybe journalists do take sides, despite your confident assurance of us to the contrary. The last thing is just that, so for years, folks on the right have said CNN is biased. CNN puts their hand on the scale. CNN, prefers Democrats to Republicans. And people at CNN have said, no, that's not the case. You just don't like it because you can't, we're Harry S. Truman. We're not giving, it's not hell. We're just giving you the truth and you think it's hell. We call them as we see them. No, you don't. CNN is, at least in this particular case, was utterly, completely, 110% in the Andrew Cuomo reputation protection business. I think it was R. Kyle Smith who said it was the Cuomo Nepotism Network. It's not like Andrew Cuomo is that good at his job. It's not like he's utterly irreplaceable. The point of CNN and all of their happy, wacky prop comedy with giant Q-tips during the pandemic was designed to tell people New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is doing a terrific job. But we now know, thanks to Janice Dean and a whole bunch of other folks, he was not doing a good job. He was doing a terrible job. But the CNN believed their job was to tell you Andrew Cuomo is swell. And not only that, they were trying to do what they could to help Andrew Cuomo evade the consequences of sexually harassing a lot of women. A lot of women. What are we up to, 11? CNN is as bad as the conservatives have said, at least in this particular set of circumstances. There is no defense. And this is not like, as my colleagues have observed, this is not like this all happened at once. This story about the Cuomo brothers has been brewing for a year, and CNN and Zucker have done everything they could to avert their eyes or tisk tisk, or we've had a chat with Chris Cuomo and he promised us he's not going to do it again. Yeah, he's ran out of brothers. He doesn't have any other brothers who are governors. Because he's not going to do it again. So I'm hoping CNN realizes this is absolutely untenable, but I don't expect them to. And I kind of think that maybe as much as he deserves to be fired and maybe burned at the stake, Chris Cuomo, maybe it's almost more useful to have him there to demonstrate to the world, no, CNN is not a meritocracy, and they don't take sexual harassment seriously, and they are not objective, and they are not treating each party equally, and they do have favorite lawmakers, and it does, when their anchor is the brother of one of the governors of one of the governor of the state that CNN is headquarters in, yes, they're going to be ludicrously biased and effectively an extension of his political operation.
Right. I don't know why he works there in the first place. And it's one thing to have a great talent who makes a lapse in judgment because he's so attached to his family. Although it would have been entirely possible for him to have helped his brother and recused himself from CNN completely and not lied about it. It's another to bend over backwards for a mediocrity or worse, such as Chris Cuomo. I asked in a piece I wrote about him a few months ago, has he wired the building with C4 and told the management, if I go, you go? What is it about this person that renders him able to weather almost any storm? He says stupid thing after stupid thing. He tells lie after lie. He was caught during coronavirus pretending to emerge from his basement. He'd had a phantom quarantine. Someone called into a radio station and said, actually, I got into an argument. Of course they did, because it's Chris Cuomo, with him while he was scouting for property at exactly the same time that he was pretending to hide underground. What is it? Does he have photographs of the CNN director that he doesn't want released? If CNN doesn't release him, it will tell us a great deal about CNN. I have no great interest in seeing people fired. But it is interesting that CNN is increasingly intolerant as an institution, increasingly of the view that we need to hold people accountable in the Orwellian phrase of the day. And yet it seems not to extend this accountability culture to its own employees. If by next year, Jeffrey Toobin and Chris Cuomo are still there, then we will know how deep its commitment to responsibility goes.
So that's a segue to the next question to you, Zan. The question you said you didn't know the answer to, I'm now going to ask you to give us an answer. Will Chris Cuomo be fired by CNN? Yes or no?
Well, in the intermediary 10 minutes or so, I've reflected on it some more, and I think the answer is no, he will not be fired.
Jim Garrity.
It hasn't happened yet. I don't understand why this would be considered the straw that breaks the camel's back. I do wonder if he's been such an enormous embarrassment that CNN kind of can't fire him. That's conceding that the critics have been right all along. Maybe the idea is that you wait 6 months, hope everybody forgets about this. Spoiler alert, we're not going to forget. And then, you know, announce that he's going off to write a book or do something else in his life.
Charlie.
Oh, I can't wait for his book. It will be so interesting. I mean, again, who is he? Why is he there? No one can answer this question. What does he bring to the table? Is there anyone alive in the United States who thinks that he would have that job if his brother weren't or hadn't been governor of New York? I think this may be the push they needed to defenestrate the man.
I really don't know. I'm going to say no, because their primetime lineup is terrible. It's not clear how it would get any better by getting rid of Chris Cuomo. We've just learned more of what we already knew about his involvement with his brother and the scandal. So I imagine there'll be some massive mea culpa and he'll drag on. I just have to say, just looking at these emails and texts and the whole thing, just the whole sense of it, both of these guys, Andrew and Chris, they just give off an overwhelming sense of thuggishness and stupidity, like dim-witted thuggishness that got him a long way. You know, Andrew Cuomo was a governor of a major U.S. state, and Chris Cuomo has a major perch in the mainstream media. So maybe there's something to be said for it, but they got caught. Andrew got what he deserved. Chris probably won't get what he deserves, but at least the exposure and embarrassment are something. With that, let's do a quick NR Plus plug. NR Plus is a digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. It is your way around our increasingly extensive, and I mean increasingly extensive, paywall that now encompasses almost all of our content. It's a metered paywall, so you get a couple bites at the apple, but then you're going to get cut off from our content. You don't want that to happen. You can, yes, try to find ways around the paywall, but it's annoying to have to do that. Plus, it's harder to do that than before because of some technological changes that have been made to the paywall. So just give in. Stop playing that game. Just sign up for NR Plus. We have great, very affordable first-time offers running at any given moment. Once you sign up and then actually log in to the website, which is a key step that sometimes people miss, you'll not just have to no longer have to deal with the paywall, but you'll see almost no ads. You know, the ads, I know they can be obnoxious. You're there at National Review to read National Review content, not to see these ads coming at you from all angles. Well, if you're logged in and signed up to NR Plus, you don't see the ads there. Almost all of them are gone. If it floats your boat, you can comment on our blog posts and articles. You can be part of the private Facebook group that is a thriving community, and you can be invited to exclusive calls and events with our writers, editors, and with various conservative newsmakers and conservative figures. So it's a great deal all around, your way to get deeper into the NR community and, importantly, at least importantly for us, to support our journalism. So please, NR Plus, if you're not already a member, join tens of thousands of fellow NR readers and just pony up the $5 or whatever it is to get started. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you are at the Philadelphia Christmas Market.
Yeah, there's actually two of them right next to each other, right by City Hall with, is it William Penn who's at the statue at the top there? You know, easy to find. One's the Made in Philadelphia Holiday Market. The other is the Christmas Village of Philadelphia. We always hit it on the weekend after Thanksgiving. If you've ever been to one of those European, I guess Germany is probably where it's most commonly thought of, as these little Christmas markets. They're selling little ornaments and all kinds of tasty goodies, and often, you know, Glühwein, which is heated up wine, and other heated up warm holiday beverages. They have an ice rink, all the kind of fun stuff you want to do in the winter. And it's, you know, we were kind of blessed with not so bad weather. I believe it runs all the way to Christmas. And like I said, there's two of them right next to each other. Absolutely terrific if you're in the Philadelphia area. And look, you know, at least as of last weekend, they were not requiring masks. They were letting people get as close as they want. So if you've missed the sense of being in a crowded place, that's a good place to do it.
So, Zan, last week you were shopping for Christmas decorations, and this week you upped your game and went and bought a Christmas tree.
I did, and I warned listeners, I think, that we were heading into the time of year where all of my light items tend to be about Advent or Christmas-related things, but this weekend we actually went and cut down our Christmas tree at a Christmas tree farm out kind of past the suburbs here in Virginia, and this is something I grew up doing with my family most years, but this is my first year married, and so we decided we were going to take up this tradition ourselves, so we went out, cut one down. And let me just say to listeners out there who maybe aren't paying attention, you got to put water in your tree as soon as you get it in the stand. Learned that one the hard way.
So, Zan, how jealous are you that Jim was at a Christmas market? Or because it was Philadelphia, a major metropolis, it didn't really count. Like if it was Frederick or Pittsburgh.
It's not Berg.
Right. I was wondering if Pittsburgh might have one that we should head up to. Our parish actually has one, I think, next weekend, but it probably won't be quite as large. So
Charlie, you've been thinking about Christmas music.
Well, I've been thinking about the outsized and profound effect on the Christmas traditions that we understand that 1950s American music has had. Obviously, everyone knows the role that Charles Dickens played in inventing Christmas. The Christmas that's described in A Christmas Carol, also his other much less successful Christmas novels, he kept trying to replicate the success, set the standard. It's the reason that long-suffering Brits such as myself spent their formative years expecting snow on Christmas and instead got just damp. It's Charles Dickens's fault. But the other sort of conceit of Christmas is provided by Frank Sinatra and Brenda Lee and Burl Ives and
Crosby.
Bing Crosby. Yeah, Bing Crosby once said that Frank Sinatra was a once-in-a-generation talent. And then he said, why did he have to exist in mine? Frank Sinatra, obviously, is the first one that comes to mind, despite how great a singer Bing Crosby is. But the point I'm making is that if you put on any music from that era, just the sound of it, forget the lyrics or the existence of bells or whatever other gimmicks they have, just the sound of it, the harmonies, the way it's recorded, it sounds Christmassy. And so as much as Charles Dickens did invent our idea of Christmas, so did 1950s America, in a way that even as somebody who grew up abroad, as I did, was instantly recognizable and makes me feel very much at home here when Christmas rolls around.
Well, I don't have a Christmas item. Instead, the other day, I set up a couple bird feeders and have been delighted that the birds have taken to them. I got a squirrel-resistant, supposedly, bird feeder. No squirrel that I have seen have made the attempt yet, but I almost sent you, Zan, some screen captures of the reviews of this bird feeder that was portrayed as something like the name of the bird feeder was like the ultimate squirrel defeating bird feeder. And then all these people sent in these zero star reviews had these pictures included of squirrels like gnawing through the plastic of these
bird feeders. Sounds familiar.
Totally defeating them. But I have another squirrel resistant bird feeder that's held up so far, but hasn't really been tested, but the birds enjoy it. And Sarah, the black oil sunflower seeds seem to be cracked for a lot of songbirds.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, so we got a lot of chickadees, cardinals, titmice, and a few other birds I'm not quite familiar with, but I got to look up. And then a suet feeder, and there I may have overdone it with the suet feeder. It's this big suet feeder that you put four huge suet cakes in. And so far, only the woodpeckers like it, but I love woodpeckers, so that's great. But I think these suet box at this point pace will last all winter. So with that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, I made a reference to Charlie's excellent story about Biden and COVID, but my real selection for the week is Ryan Mills, who is out over in Chicago covering the Jussie Smollett trial. Wrote a bit about the trial in today's Morning Jolt. I think this is actually a much bigger deal. I'll understand if you're like, God, Jussie Smollett, it was almost 3 years ago. And so it's easy to say, this nut job actor and all that kind of stuff. I think there's actually two very big consequences to this trial. One, we may have a chance of seeing genuine accountability here. First consequence is that Jussie Smollett tried to offer a false narrative of what this country is, that there were crazy white supremacists rampaging through Chicago at 2 a.m. on the coldest night of winter that attacked him. And folks like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris chose to believe it. They said, oh, yes, we're so sorry this happened. And of course, you know, everybody in Chicago is like, but that doesn't make any sense. We don't have nut jobs doing that in the middle of the night. Nobody in the right mind would be out in that night or the night in that kind of a, you know, cold winter's night anyway. And then the second thing is the prosecutor just basically decided to drop all the charges against Jussie Smollett, I suspect, because out of blatantly political motives. So maybe we're going to see something fixed here. Ryan Mills is out there. He's already filed some good reports and look forward to reading his stuff through the rest of the week.
Dan, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece on NRO from yesterday morning called On Due Burdens. It's by Yuval Levin and Adam White. And they're doing kind of a preview of the oral argument that the court will hear tomorrow in this big upcoming abortion case. And they do a really good job of taking a look at the Mississippi law in question, but in particular, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and how we need to have this view of a due burden as, you know, our dependencies on one another, what we owe to one another, and order our society around that rather than, you know, removing the expendables or the inconvenient.
Charlie Cook.
My piece is also on abortion. It's not new. It's from the Roe issue of the magazine, but it is new on the website, or at least it's featured on the website today. It is by Ramesh Panuru. It is called The Corruption of History. And Ramesh goes through how, in his words, the reign of Roe v. Wade has relied from the very beginning on a false and sometimes fraudulent version of history. It is absolutely fascinating. I suspect that he made a similar argument in his book, but I haven't read his book. I will rectify that. And this, at least for now, was a worthy substitute.
So my pick is Jim Garrity's Jolt this morning about the Jussie Smollett case, which is a great table setter for this trial and makes some of the important points that you just heard Jim outline himself on this very podcast. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or countless game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zant. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to Made In and Babel. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.